Hello, this is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated November 16th. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Today's lead article, Top of the Fold, Back to the Future for Raleigh's L Building, by Amanda Jones Hoyle. From Raleigh, it looks like it'll be back to Plan A for the developers of the L Building in downtown Raleigh. When Greg Haddam's Empire Properties was first negotiating in 2006 with Wake County to construct a commercial building around the county's new parking deck at McDowell and Davie Streets, it wanted to build residential condo units with a few restaurant and retail spaces at street level. But for the past 5 years, the downtown Raleigh real estate company has been marketing the space for office rental instead, and still no takers. Now, according to a new site plan filed with the city, Empire Properties is again proposing to build up to 100 residential units atop retail at the proposed L Building site. His original plan was for residential with retail, and we were fine with that, says Wake County Manager David Cook, who helped negotiate a public-private partnership agreement and subsequent extensions with Haddam. We're fine with when he wanted office over retail. I don't think we'll have any problem if he wants to go back to residential. Cook says county leaders just want something to happen at the site, and sooner rather than later. We want him to be successful, and it's our desire he create and build buildings to wrap that parking deck, he says. Neither Haddam nor Empire Properties President Andrew Stewart returned calls for comment about the newly submitted L Building plans. Empire is partnering with Arlington, Virginia-based Concord Eastridge in the development and ownership of the project. According to Concord, the revised L Building plan would cost about $15 million to build. It would include 89 residential units plus 11,300 square feet of retail space and could open in 2013. Wake County finished building the $20 million nine-level parking deck in 2009, and for 2 years its bare concrete walls waited for Empire and Concord to secure a financing package and begin construction of the building that would encase the parking deck's north and east walls, forming the L shape for which the building was named. The County Board of Commissioners agreed to extend its agreement with Empire Properties through May 2013 if the developer would find a way to cover the deck's bare walls. Empire sponsored an art contest among the students at NC State University's College of Design and installed a 15-banner mural called the Fantastic Sky Race in 2011. In the past 12 months, 123 single-family and multifamily residential units have sold in the downtown Raleigh district, according to reports by Downtown Raleigh Alliance. Of those units sold, about half would be classified as new unit sales, ranging from condominium buildings such as The West, PNC Plaza, and Bloomsbury Estates projects. But the inventory of new condo units available for sale in downtown Raleigh has been dwindling rapidly since 2009, when condo developers stopped building new buildings. In the third quarter, only 25% of the 36 units sold were classified as new. David Diaz, president and CEO of Downtown Raleigh Alliance, points out that occupancy in downtown Raleigh condo buildings is now 96%. I really think it's the perfect storm for downtown living, Diaz says. Nationally, demand for rental has been high. Couple that with a metro area that is still growing, and demand for downtown specifically because of the high occupancy level. I think we're just getting started. Now, this week's lead article on the November 16th cover of Triangle Business Journal, Gone, $185 million of your money. BioCryst revised work on vaccine when feds were spending. This article is written by Lauren K. Onisores and was from Durham. When executives at BioCryst Pharmaceuticals threw up their hands on November 7th and recognized that further development of a once promising flu treatment had reached the level of futility, it likely ended any hope that U.S. taxpayers would recoup $185 million paid to the company to develop the drug. That's how much BioCryst spent in federal money over the 5 years it worked to bring an intravenous form of a drug candidate called Pirmivir to market. To understand why the government gave a small private company such a vast sum, one needs to check the nation's mood in 2004 and 2005, when it was in the grip of a global panic over the spread of avian flu, a strain for which no vaccine existed. The U.S. government wheeled into action, cutting big checks that went to private companies to conduct research, fast-track promising vaccines, and even erect manufacturing plants. Besides the contract signed with BioCryst, Swiss Pharma Novartis got $486 million in federal money to build a vaccine plant in Holly Springs. Novartis's plant is humming while BioCryst's U.S. Pirmivir program appears to be dead. What went wrong? How did BioCryst plow through $185 million with minimal success? How could a U.S. government agency continue to plow this much money without any result? Pirmivir is an experimental intravenous drug aimed at inhibiting the interactions of an enzyme critical to influenza spread in a patient whose symptoms are severe enough for hospitalization. The IV delivery meant patients could receive the dose quickly and at appropriate levels. The drug candidate actually had a previous life in a pill form that was developed through a partnership between BioCryst and Johnson & Johnson. When the oral formulation failed in Phase 3 clinical trials, Johnson & Johnson pulled out of the partnership. Pirmivir appeared dead in the water until, that is, the avian flu panic hit. Charles Bug, BioCryst's chief executive at the time, told the New York Times in 2005 that he, quote, never even thought of the prospect of resurrecting it until the avian flu came along, end quote. But much like the 2001 terrorist attack led to billions of taxpayer dollars going to support ailing airlines, the flu panic prompted an immediate and costly response. To resurrect Pirmivir, BioCryst would need a big wallet backer, and that's what it found in BARDA. BARDA, the Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority, which is part of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. The agency decided to bet on BioCryst, agreeing to a 5-year contract worth a total of $235 million, with payments coming as stipulated milestones were achieved. Through September 30th, BioCryst says it has claimed $185.4 million of the contracted amount. In securities filings, the company says it expects additional payments, but does not reveal the amount. BARDA officials in Washington were unable to provide any additional details. BioCryst researchers went back to work on the drug and gained approval for it to be sold in Japan and Korea. Analysts had no reason to think it would not be approved for the U.S. market. Then came the bad news, which the company announced on November 7th. Analyzing a trial involving 119 humans, an independent data monitoring committee concluded that there were no significant differences in the outcomes when comparing patients treated with Pirmivir and those treated with standard care. The analysis called for a new sample size of 320 patients, the predefined futility boundary, which meant the trial would be too expensive to continue. Executives told investors not to expect Pirmivir to continue to be developed for the U.S. market. The following day, BioCryst stock, which reached $4.50 a share on October 20th, dropped by 40% and is now priced at or about $1.50. For years, this had been the one drug that was most closely associated with the name BioCryst, MLV and company analyst Ed Ark says. It's also BioCryst's only late-stage drug. The final chapter for Pirmivir has probably been written. We are proceeding with a full analysis of unblinded data from the trial, and a final decision will be made following completion of the analysis and further discussions with our development partners. However, it is unlikely that Pirmivir development for U.S. registration will continue, Chief Medical Officer William Sheridan told investors this month. Analysts say the odds were long for Pirmivir from the beginning. As Bug said, no thought had been given to reviving it until the flu panic, leading to the conclusion that work on the drug might not have been revived except for the federal cash. Even if Permavir had gained approval, the market for it would have been small and would have provided little in the way of revenue. The Permavir program really didn't have a huge market value because this is not like a drug for folks to take on a regular basis when they have seasonal flu, says Noble financial analyst Rahul Jahuja. This is for hospitalized influenza. And the primary customer, he says, would have been the U.S. government stockpiling it in the event of pandemic flu. It doesn't happen every year, Jahuza says. That's why this market is not a very attractive one for most investors. It was great for the company to have non-dilutive financing from the government and then develop this program, but from the point of view of the market opportunity, it was not a big deal. Next up, Man in Motion. Trained as a sculptor, Chuck Pell's ideas move, literally. This article is written by Lauren K. Onisores and is from Durham. Chuck Pell doesn't like to sit down. He paces, he leans, he gestures, but he can't sit still. Maybe it's because Pell can't stop thinking. It's that kind of intensity that led him to co-found Necton Research out of Duke University. Colleagues predict that the intense drive of Pell, now chief science officer at Durham Medical Device Company, Physicent, will keep him making impressions long after the recently announced departure of iRobot from the Triangle scene. Bedford, Massachusetts' iRobot purchased Necton in 2008. Area entrepreneurs could learn from Pell, particularly if they find themselves looking for change. Varied interests are not what flip-flopped Pell from designing oceanic robots at Necton to inventing surgery tools at Physicent. He says, after all, he reasons, swimming robots and surgical instruments are really the same thing. To understand his thought process, you really have to understand Pell, who trained as a sculptor before moving on to work on robotic dinosaurs. He became obsessed with movement during art school. His sculptures didn't stand in hallways or gardens. They moved, swam, and flew, taking Pell from an art school in his home state of Michigan to Notre Dame University in Indiana. After college is when he hit California to work on the dinosaurs. Tired of job interviews and tired of waiting, he put on a suit and went to work, solving technical issues in robot dinosaurs that would become mainstays at museums across the nation. Less than a week after he finished the work, the company hired him, retroactively. Sometimes that's what you've got to do, he says, referring to proving his worth before getting the job. It was Steve Vogel, a research professor at Duke University's biology department, who pulled Pell out of his Paleolithic work and into the Triangle. Vogel had been writing a book on biological fluid mechanics, and Pell, entranced by the science, called him out of the clear blue. When Chuck starts talking, it's hard not to listen, Vogel says. Vogel put Pell in touch with a colleague, Stephen Wainwright, who was launching what would become the Biodesign Studio at Duke. It didn't take many conversations to get Pell to Durham to be part of it all. And work at the studio led to Necton Research in 1994. For 3.5 billion years, Pell says, attributing the statement to Wainwright, the good designs have been eating the bad designs, and so after a while, you get good designs. Good designs for underwater robot drones, despite not hiring oceanic engineers. If you hire ocean engineers, you will get the ocean engineer solutions that everyone knows, he explains. If you hire smart people and give them problems that seem new to them, they'll have new solutions. He sold Necton Research to iRobot in 2008, 3 days before the crash. But retirement was impossible for Pell. He connected with an old friend who had helped him with his submarine robot project, Hugh Crenshaw, now CEO of Physicent. Crenshaw was studying surgical tools, which are really the same thing as underwater robots. Think about it, Pell explains. It's all salt water. Well, it is true that swimming robots and surgical tools operate in a saline environment with a lot of people depending on the outcome. Crenshaw saw, specifically, that the biomechanics of surgical retraction, the devices that open a chest cavity for heart surgery, are old-school techniques that remain the status quo. We started popping off stories rapid fire with each other, and the company was born, Crenshaw says. Pell and team say they have come up with a robotic way to lessen the impact of a chest splitter and to make thoracic surgery safer with a tool that should be before the U.S. Food and Drug Administration in the next few years. Others looking for a new challenges might need to take on Pell's attitude. Don't look for the differences between your current career and where you'd like to go. Look for the similarities. After all, it's all salt water. While Pell is fully invested in Physicent, he is still paying attention to his old company and calls iRobot's decision to close its maritime unit, what's left of the company he founded, short-sighted. There's more water than land, he says. If you don't think that's important, ask the people in Lower Manhattan right now. And now, UNC cost per degree higher than the nation's. By Jason DeBrun from Chapel Hill. Despite trending downward for the past few years, schools within the University of North Carolina system spent $70,380 per degree awarded in 2010 and 11, nearly $10,000 more per degree than the national average. That's according to figures from the Alexandria, Virginia-based Integrated Post-Secondary Education Data System, or IPEDS, the primary federal entity for collecting and analyzing data related to education. The $70,380 to the UNC system spent per degree, while the lowest since 2005 and 6, was still higher than for the years at the beginning of the past decade. The Washington, D.C.-based Delta Cost Project, which focuses on spending as part of the college cost problem, according to its website, compared spending per degree on average since the beginning of this century. The project found that institutions that offer master's degrees, but not doctorates, have the lowest cost per completion among the four-year universities, averaging $54,000 per degree in 2010. Research universities such as NC State and Chapel Hill were in the low $60,000 range through the 2000s. By contrast, spending per degree for the entire UNC system increased by 24% from 2004 to 2008 to a high of $74,422 that year, university data show. In terms of spending per full-time student, UNC's numbers inched up in 2010-11 after 2 years of decline. System President Tom Ross didn't have much to say about the figures, which were contained in a report to the UNC Board of Governors, but he stressed that lower spending was good only as long as the education quality stays the same, an admittedly difficult measure to gauge. The figures in the UNC report look at school years between 2003 and 2011. For the 2011-12 year, the state legislature handed UNC $414 million in budget cuts, meaning the spending per student and spending per degree will almost certainly see a significant drop. Those numbers have not yet been tallied. For the 2010-2011 school year, the UNC system racked up $8.5 billion in total expenditures, though that figure includes spending for items such as hospital services and research. Education expenses totaled $3.4 billion that year, of which two-thirds went to instruction. Students have been picking up a growing share of the cost of education as states have figuratively tightened their belts. That's not the only reason for increased cost, however, argues Kevin Carey, the director of the Education Policy Program at the New America Foundation, a nonprofit in Washington, D.C. that analyzes public policy. In an opinion piece for the Chronicle of Higher Education, a publication that closely tracks colleges and universities, he argues that the ease with which students can borrow for college plays a role in higher costs. This year, analysts estimate that combined student debt surpassed the $1 trillion mark and vaulted it above total credit card debt. Carey blames that on universities that have become adept at appearing to be doing students a favor by allowing them to borrow and lumping loans into confusingly described financial aid packages that must be repaid with interest. It will be a perilous time for higher learning unless the tide of student debt can be brought under some manner of control, he writes. The situation could only get worse if the Pell program of federal grants is cut, as seems possible with the looming fiscal cliff. Mark Ken Tronowitz, publisher of FastWeb.com, a website that helps families navigate financial aid, says the Pell Grant program faces an $8 billion funding shortfall and surmises that the elimination of subsidized interest payments might be one of the first items to meet the axe. Beyond that, more requirements of full cost disclosures up front will become more commonplace, he says. This will give families a better picture of the total cost of college and help them make decisions about where to send their students. Next up, Butterball CEO says rogue workers caused abuses. By Amanda Jones Hoyle from Garner. Going into the biggest turkey selling season of the year, the last thing Butterball CEO Rod Brennerman wanted to discuss was another account of alleged animal abuse at some of Butterball's turkey farms. Do we really have to talk about it? He says. Brennerman is quick to defend the company of 5,555 employees that he took leadership of just over a year ago, and he's equally quick to denounce misdeeds of any rogue farm workers. We take this stuff very seriously, he says. We don't condone that kind of behavior. We take immediate action when we need to. We have done a lot of re-educating, training, and retraining in the last year. The first allegations of abuse of turkeys came in December from a group called Mercy for Animals that had managed to get undercover film of the acts of cruelty. Then, on November 14th, the same group said it had uncovered more cases of abuse at North Carolina farms. Stories appeared across the nation, many accompanied by photos of frozen Butterball turkeys. Such news is not welcome for a company with one of the most iconic brands among U.S. consumer products. As CEO, Brennerman faces a constant battle to stay on top of any issues that might taint that Butterball name and hurt the company's profitability. Marketing professor Jan Bennett Steenkamp at UNC Chapel Hill's Kenan Flagler Business School notes that a brand name to a company can be very important if it is trying to build a relationship with a customer. Brands are a lot about emotion, Steenkamp says. It says something about the product, and many of our associations, positively and negatively, are about a product often centered around that brand name. Butterball LLC is the largest turkey producer in the United States, according to industry source Watt Poultry USA. The company produces 1.2 billion pounds of turkey a year, and it is on track to exceed the nearly $1.38 billion in sales recorded in 2011, according to federal documents filed by one of its parent companies, Seaboard Corporation of Merriam, Kansas. Butterball is 50% owned by Seaboard and 50% owned by Maxwell Farms Group of Goldsboro. Last year, about 31% of Butterball's total sales volume came into the fourth quarter, when a high percentage of its whole frozen turkeys are sold for Thanksgiving and Christmas holiday meals. Brennerman is working on ways to make the company less dependent on the holiday turkey sales and more efficient at the same time with the processes he has in place. One of his first big decisions after taking over the full-time CEO post in September 2011 was announcing the closure of the company's processing plant in Longmont, Colorado, that employed 350 people. It's never an easy decision to shut down a plant, but that one was less than 50% utilized, and a lot of the product they were making was coming back to the East Coast, he says. I don't take that sort of thing lightly, but it was for the good of the whole and the right thing to do. Brennerman says none of the Butterball's five other production plants are being considered for closure, and that he may instead be looking for ways to reinvest in the plants to begin expanding production again. The years 2008 and 2009 were tough for the turkey business because grain prices were rising and turkey prices were down. We all had to get to a point that prices could start going back up again, he says. About 70% of the cost of raising a turkey is in the grain and feed for the bird. Butterball, over the past few years, has been expanding its line of products, experimenting with its product lines and packaging, adding sausages and flavored deli meats. It expanded its production line at a processing plant in Carthage, Missouri, this year, for example, to add new turkey burger products. Brennerman says one of the reasons he was convinced to leave his post as president and CEO of pork producer Seaboard Foods to take the job at Butterball was because of the potential he could see in the brand. At Seaboard Foods, we had good assets, good people, and a solid business model. When I got a chance to be introduced to this company, I saw the same three things plus one more. An iconic brand with a ton of potential, he says. It's being part of something cool and working with a lot of cool people. Next up, on the internet, below the radar, Little Bank is Thriving, by Lee Weisbecker. This article comes from Wilmington. The last community bank chartered in North Carolina before the financial meltdown of 2008, Wilmington-based Live Oak Bank has been setting its own pace. As other banks have been treading water or contracting, the online specialty lender has continued to grow, both in terms of loans and profits. And now, according to Federal Reserve documents, Live Oak is about to make its first acquisition and launch out in a new direction. Live Oak's holding company will acquire 100% of the stock of Cleveland, Ohio-based Government Loan Solutions, GLS, a company set up in 2006 to put a value on the bundles of SBA and other loans that are packaged into securities for sale to investors. Terms of the deal have not been disclosed. We are still waiting for Fed approval, so there is not much we're going to say, says Live Oak Vice Chairman Lee Williams. The Wilmington Bank is a brainchild of banking veteran James S. Chip Mahan III, who opened its doors in May 2008. Beginning his banking career with Wachovia back in the early 70s, Mahan went on to start Enid, Oklahoma-based Security First Network Bank, credited with being one of the first, if not the first, online lender. Taking a page from that very book, Live Oak began life in the same fashion, offering online access to small business administration-backed loans to specialized groups, among them veterinarians, dentists, and pharmacists. Since 2010, the bank has grown total assets by 44% to $301 million and the total loans by 27% to $215 million, and now claims to be the second largest originator of small business loans in the country. Profits have risen from $3.1 million in 2010 to $12 million as of September 30th. The bank also has moved into a new 36,000 square foot headquarters in the Port City. One of Live Oak's earliest backers is Raleigh-based banker-turned-equity investor Kel Landis, who sits on the bank's board. Asked to comment about the new direction the bank is taking, Landis says, "I know all about it, but I would rather it come from management." Attempts to reach GLS founder Robert Judge for comment were not successful. In a company blog on the Live Oak deal, however, Judge says that once the transaction goes through, GLS will continue operating its Cleveland office and will also open an office in Wilmington. According to Williams, GLS, whose operations will be kept separate from those of Live Oak, will become a subsidiary of the Live Oak Bank Holding Company. GLS's specialty, he adds, is using statistical analysis to put a value on SBA loans that are being packaged and then bundled into securities for sale on the investor market. It derives fee income from performing such valuation services for up to 200 banks, making SBA and U.S. Department of Agriculture, USDA, loans. By purchasing the bundles, investors are providing money to make additional SBA loans. In the aftermath of the 2008 meltdown, investor appetite for SBA and other asset-backed securities plunged. On the SBA side, however, the secondary market has snapped back into the intervening years, says agency spokesman Mike Stamler in Washington, D.C. He says, "It was helped along by a number of steps we took, among them being the government's decision to give banks lending out SBA-backed dollars larger guarantees against the default." Banks become a lot less visible when they do this, says bank analyst Don Coker, and in a way, it's meant to do that. In fact, says Coker, going private is a strategy that allows a bank to slash expenses, cut problem assets and problem loan set-asides, and over time, improve profitability before they look for ways of becoming more visible again. Both banks went private using a portion of the Jumpstart Our Business Startups, or JOBS Act, which became U.S. law in April. It allows banks or bank holding companies to terminate their registrations if their number of shareholders of record is below 1,200. The cutoff used to be 300. Patriot State, which started up in 2008, has 800 shareholders. The Jobs Act also raised the shareholder threshold requiring companies to register under the security laws to 2,000. The old threshold was 500. Patriot CEO Greg Strickland, in an interview at the Times, said he expected to save $50,000 in SEC reporting and related costs. Barber, up to $200,000. North State and Patriot State were far from alone, however. As of October 11th, a total of 96 mostly community banks nationwide have deregistered under Jobs Act provisions, says Harris Molly of Charlottesville, Virginia-based SNL Financial. In recent weeks, he added, the pace has slowed. And now, compared to the nation, Triangle University's lag in diversity. This article is written by Jason DeBruin and is from Raleigh. The Triangle's three research universities trail national averages in terms of minority enrollment. Universities across the nation average a student body that is 55% white, 13% black, and 12% Hispanic. At Duke University, UNC Chapel Hill, and NC State, the ratios are less than 9% black and less than 8% Hispanic. These latest numbers come at a time when race has again taken center stage in higher education, in large part because of a challenge to affirmative action guidelines brought by Abigail Fisher, a Texas student who was denied entrance to University of Texas in Austin. She is white and claims she was denied entrance in favor of minority students, even though she is more academically qualified. The case went to the U.S. Supreme Court, which heard arguments on October 12. Essentially, her argument boils down to a simple question. Should universities be allowed to consider race as one of many factors in admissions? The University of Texas argued yes, and so does UNC Chapel Hill. In a brief filed in that case, UNC Chapel Hill argues that being allowed to consider race is crucial to providing a good education. As a flagship university, UNC believes that the freedom to recruit and enroll a diverse student body is necessary to fulfill its educational mission and its core commitments to the state and its future, reads the brief. Any holding that would foreclose its ability to consider race in admissions would undercut decades of Supreme Court precedents and establish a new standard of review that would prohibit UNC and other public institutions of higher education, long recognized as special marketplaces of ideas, from making their own determinations about who will be successful students. Put more succinctly, quote, the UNC brief argues that some limited use of race as part of a holistic admission systems strengthens the excellence of the student body and better prepares students to lead in their respective fields after graduation, end quote. This was said by John Charles Jack Boger, Dean of the UNC School of Law, at a roundtable discussion on September 17th, also known as Constitution Day. Although minority enrollment at UNC Chapel Hill is below national averages and below the makeup of the general population, the university enrolls more minorities than many of its peers, says Stephen Farmer, UNC Chapel Hill's Vice Provost of Enrollment and Undergraduate Admissions. The University of Georgia, the University of Michigan at Ann Arbor, and the University of Virginia, for example, have smaller total minority populations. Conversely, the University of Florida and the University of Maryland at College Park have higher total minority populations. Farmer believes it is crucial for universities such as Chapel Hill to consider race. Admissions should not be based in race, but be conscious of race in a sparing way, he says. The racial makeup of some universities makes sense from a geographic standpoint. The University of Texas at Austin, for example, is below the national average of black enrollment with 4%, but above the average of Hispanic enrollment with 17%. On the West Coast, the University of California at Berkeley, Davis, Irvine, Los Angeles, Riverside, and San Diego all have Asian enrollments between 30 and 45%, well above the national average. Academia Industry Publication, The Chronicle of Higher Education, compiled a list of more than 1,500 institutions. An accompanying article argues that black men are increasingly deciding not to go to college out of their own volition, not because they can't get accepted. A lot of the black men we are losing are not the ones going to prison, according to Ivy Tolson, associate professor at Howard University in Washington, D.C., who was quoted in the article. They're not hanging around with the wrong crowd, they're not being arrested, and they just can't afford to go to college. And they can't take risk with their money. This week's spotlight is on healthcare. And the article is entitled, NCSU's Chemists' Long Fight with MRSA. The article is written by Lauren K. Onisores from Raleigh. Chemist Christian Melander may not seem like a warrior stationed in a brick-walled office at NC State University, but he has faced a deadly foe for the past 5 years, MRSA, a bacterial strain that, according to recent reports, is in every hospital. Pronounced MRSA, the acronym stands for Methicillin-Resistant Staphylococcus aureus. Melander, a professor, CEO, and family man, has recently published research that could pave the way to putting the bacterium in its place while avoiding doses that are dangerously high for some patients. There are still a lot of questions, Melander says, but the smile on his face indicates that for now, for the first time, there are also some answers. To understand the battle, one must first understand the war that has raged between doctors and MRSA since its drug resistance was discovered in 1961. A 2011 report by the Association for Professionals in Infection Control and Epidemiology found that the bacterium was found in all wards throughout most hospitals and that most fail to track patients' infections back to the particular rooms where they start. About a quarter of all people are believed to carry MRSA harmlessly on their skin or in their upper respiratory tract. An infection occurs when the bacterium enters the body through a wound or by penetrating deeper into the lungs. Pew Research studies link 19,000 U.S. deaths annually to MRSA and say the annual cost of treating hospitalized patients with the infection is between $3.2 billion and $4.2 billion. Melander started out studying molecules that disrupt biofilms, the naturally protective coating on bacteria. His research showed another use for the molecules. They could disrupt MRSA's defense process. His compounds short-circuit the system by which bacteria respond to threats, and MRSA was the perfect application. The bacteria don't figure out there's a threat, and so they don't really mount a good response, he says. We are basically not allowing them to sense their environment in the way that they're used to. Now Melander is using nearly $2 million from the U.S. Department of Defense to investigate the antibiotic-resistant bacteria for war wound applications. The research is early and about to go into animal testing through a national partnership with the Walter Reed National Military Medical Center in Washington, D.C. If testing shows it's effective, it could work at smaller doses than currently available drugs, whose ever higher doses are putting stress on some patients' bodies. One problem with doing antibiotic development, the bacteria will figure it out and they'll pick up resistance, Melander says. Our compounds don't seem to have that problem, at least in a test tube. One of his companies, Raleigh's Agile Sciences, could be among the commercial suitors for the technology, but Melander estimates industry callers are still at least a year away. Melander found Agile in 2007 to do antibacterial research. Three commercially available drugs attack the bacteria. Vancomycin from Eli Lilly, Zyvox from Pfizer, and Cubist Pharmaceuticals. Vancomycin has been around since the 1950s and is losing its efficiency. And now it's time for a better world. News about people and groups in the Triangle making a difference with their giving and philanthropic activities. This article is entitled Meredith Well Underway and Aims to Top $43 Million. From the Philanthropy News Desk of Todd Cohen. Meredith College is gearing up for the quiet phase of a campaign with a goal expected to be well in excess of the $43 million it raised in its last campaign, which ended 7 years ago. Funds for the drive, which is likely to enter the public phase in 2013 or 2014, would be used to support the goals of a new strategic plan in the school's Board of Trustees approved in October. It calls for more scholarships and faculty development, improved enrollment and student retention through support for faculty and student development and leadership, improvements in information technology and infrastructure, greater visibility and marketing for the school, and stronger employee compensation and benefits. Meredith, with 1,700 women undergraduate students and 300 co-ed graduate students, is working with Winston-Salem consulting firm Capital Development Services to test the feasibility of its new campaign and help set a goal. The school raises about $6 million a year in private support, which includes $1 million through its annual fund, which includes gifts of up to $5,000. It aims, over the course of the campaign, to increase the annual fund to $1.5 million, says Lenny Barton, Vice President for Institutional Advancement. Meredith also raises $3 million a year in major gifts, or of those $25,000 or more, and $2 million in planned or deferred gifts, typically through wills and estates. Planned giving represents the school's strongest fundraising strategy, says Barton, who joined Meredith 2.5 years ago, after working at NC State University for 33 years, most recently as Associate Vice Chancellor for Alumni Relations. Meredith has generated $29 million in planned giving commitments in the past 30 years, he says. He says the campaign represents an opportunity to engage the school's 20,000 alumni, including roughly 6,000 who live in the Triangle, and raise awareness about Meredith and its ongoing focus on preparing women to succeed as leaders. The new strategic plan, for example, calls for students to develop personal plans for their academic life, their extracurricular leadership activities, their financial stability, and their jobs and careers. We're talking about an individual plan that each student creates, Barton says. Efforts people may not know about that are underway or in the works at Meredith, Barton says, include new programs in healthcare and criminology, and a joint engineering program with NC State that lets students earn undergraduate degrees from both schools. Joe Allen, a 1980 graduate who in April 2011 became Meredith's first alumna president and only its second female president, says she wants the school to be more visible, more bold, in reaching out to prospective students and supporters. This institution is beloved by the people who know her, she says, and for people who don't know the institution yet, I think they're going to fall in love with it. This week's guest opinion column is from Laurie O'Keefe, Chief Operating Officer of the Triangle Community Foundation, and Jennifer Toll Whiteside, President and CEO of the North Carolina Community Foundation. It's entitled Smart Philanthropy. The Triangle, like much of America, has a lot to be grateful for in this season of giving thanks, but we also face huge challenges. In addressing them, we are fortunate to be able to work through the philanthropic sector to pool resources and find shared solutions to problems that affect our entire community. To do that, philanthropy itself needs to do a better job in putting its resources to work. Our community attracts smart people and innovative employers, and our schools, colleges, and universities produce smart graduates and workers, but the region is also home to nagging poverty, poor health, illiteracy, and other social ills. With a damaged economy and elected leaders looking for ways to cut spending, the job of fixing our most urgent social problems increasingly will fall to the social sector, including traditional philanthropy. Our region enjoys a rich mix of nonprofits, philanthropic foundations, corporate giving programs, donors and volunteers, women's funds, and giving circles. The Triangle is also home to a broad range of professional advisors and other groups that work with nonprofits and individuals to help them be more strategic and effective in their charitable work. Sadly, however, too many charities and other groups working for social good in our region overlap, duplicate one another, or work in isolation as they try to fix these problems that affect us all. We have an opportunity now to do a better job thinking and working together to put our knowledge, our time, and our money to more effective use and find coordinated strategies to make sure we are making a difference. How can we better coordinate our abundant resources and put them to work to help ensure that families can lift themselves from poverty, for example, or that kids and adults get the schooling and training they need to find good jobs, or that people in need have access to basic health care, or that women can free themselves and their children from abusive relationships, to name just a few of the huge challenges we face. Our two organizations are known as community foundations, a hybrid breed of charity that was established in Cleveland nearly a century ago. Community foundations work with individuals and institutions to create and manage charitable funds that support a broad range of local needs, including specific needs the donors and funders care about. We function as a kind of philanthropic matchmaker, connecting resources with charities that serve people and places in need. Based on the work of our own organizations and of the individuals and groups we serve, philanthropy in the Triangle can be more effective and make a bigger impact on our biggest problems if we work together in cooperative and strategic ways. This week's guest column is by Charles Watts. Charles Watts lives in Emerald Isle and is a national business consultant specializing in business growth and the current economy. The title of this article is Legacy of a Caring Entrepreneur. When we think of heroes in the Triangle, many might think of the local football players and their statistics and enthusiasm for their team. I just left one of my heroes and coaches for the last time. He was backed up against his own goal line. It was fourth down, and he did not have many options for the next play. Jerry Richmond was diagnosed in May with stage 4 lung cancer. He died on November 10th, and there is no noisy crowd to cheer him on anymore. But he, like many heroes, was used to that. You see, he came to Raleigh in the 1970s and quietly took the manufacturing and business community on his own terms. He built businesses. His first one, Southeastern Machine and Tool Incorporated, lives and thrives today. In fact, he just went back for a reunion of sorts when Republican Vice President candidate Paul Ryan came to town for a rally after his nomination, and Jerry was recognized. But what you don't know is that Jerry was a hero to this community. He created jobs not only at Southeastern, but many, many more companies, including one that was recently sold internationally for more than $50 million, that he was instrumental in creating. Most people can recognize the beauty of a winning football team and the effect the coach has on that winning season. It is tougher to realize the infinitely more complex beauty of building a living, breathing company, of making money, of the stark realization that many of your employees have children who depend on your decisions for their short-term and long-term security. Jerry treated employees like family. He bled inside for the ones who needed firing, but he fired them, because that was what was needed for the growth and security of the company. Most companies don't recognize that the baggy eyes in the morning are from endless hours and sleepless nights that haunt the startup artist, like Jerry. They usually have no knowledge of the personal missed payroll so that employees can have theirs, but heroes sacrifice quietly. Sometimes, successful entrepreneurs spawn new companies when they didn't intend to, when employees split off and form new companies. Old wounds heal and turn to pride as Jerry considered the part he played in his former employees' successes. This hero of mine gave me and many others opportunity, encouragement, and put his money where his mouth was. And he believed in me. He taught me that without love, belief in, and faithfulness to family, leadership in a company is not possible. He taught me how to listen, the most difficult art there is. He led me to realize the greedier one gets, the less money you make. That people get trapped into management and forget about leadership, especially self-leadership. That you develop leadership with opportunity and expectations, that rewards are earned, not given. Maybe Jerry didn't set out to teach me all of these things, but that is what heroes do. They influence lives, and as I go about consulting my victims, don't realize I'm simply passing on many things that this hero passed on to me. And he continues to influence lives far and wide without knowing, but that is the effect of a real hero. Jerry's creativity was a dividend for this community that will continue for long after his game is ended. Most of you probably don't know Jerry, but I hope you have had the chance to learn at the foot of someone who was like him. What I have just described is what a father should be. He should instill leadership, a self-reliance, and respect. He was like that to me. So after you read this about Jerry, please close your eyes and pray for a great coach in the post-game and think about your family, co-workers, and friends, and how you can inspire them the way Jerry inspired me. Jerry would like that. You know, it's tradition that freshmen at Duke University at the beginning of each year engage in bench wars, moving outdoor benches from spots where they make sense to places where they don't, say in a public restroom. But this year's class, the class of 2016, doesn't seem to understand the meaning of the word prank because they're destroying the benches. L.B. Bergeen, East Campus Assistant Dean for Residence Life, wrote in an email to the Chronicle, the student newspaper, "There is a time and place for good-spirited competition between the houses, but the line has been crossed. These actions are at best immature and at worst disturbingly disrespectful and a poor representation of the class of 2016 to the rest of the Duke community. And it cost anywhere from $300 to $700 to repair a damaged bench," Bergeen says. ClubSoft North America, a software company owned by Raleigh entrepreneur and golf mogul John McConnell, has expanded operations with an office in Boston. McConnell acquired the company, which develops software to help manage the operations of private clubs, and has put it under the helm of longtime right-hand man Ray McDonald. For example, the software features online reservation capabilities and a private social network. CEO McDonald says the ClubSoft Links products has really developed quite a following in the private club market, and we see that team continuing to expand. Carrie Seddon, who will be ClubSoft's Director of Client Services, is working out of the Boston office, which is in Beantown's trendy South End. And now, North Carolina Central University in Durham on Veterans Day, November 12, officially opened the doors to an on-campus veterans center that will cater to the needs of the school's more than 400 student veterans. The Thurgood Marshall College Fund granted the university $18,000 to help set up the center, which is in the Miller Morgan Building. NCCU Veterans Coordinator Tamika Davis says a campus is unfamiliar territory for many veterans who are accustomed to a structured environment. She says that's often the opposite of what happens in a classroom from college. Durham-based Little Hotties sent more than 10,000 hand warmers to relief organizations in New York and New Jersey, trying to dig out from the massive cleanup still needed after remnants of Hurricane Sandy hit the East Coast. The air-activated hand warmers are being distributed to those who are without power and heat, as well as those who are helping the massive cleanup and relief efforts. Little Hotties is a brand owned and manufactured by Implus Foot Care, LLC of Durham. Cary has set about helping its residents and visitors navigate their way around downtown a little better. The town plans to install 100 wayfinding signs by the end of November, courtesy of the town's wayfinding installation project. The project will cost $313,600 and is being fully funded by the town. A Raleigh nonprofit called Hope Reigns is providing sessions in which kids of soldiers stationed at Fort Bragg can spend time with rescued horses. The program is really dedicated to the brave children who live in the shadow of uncertainty as their parent serves our country, says Kim Tuchert, founder and president of Hope Reigns. "Our rescued horses have suffered similar traumas and heartbreak. And it's this commonality that triggers an instant and powerful bond between the horse and child." Okay, quick. Who knows the name Ralphie Parker? If you answered, it's the Shoot Your Eye Out Kid from Christmas Story, you win the goose. Why mention this? Because the Cary Players are reprising the Christmas movie classic on stage for a showing at the newly opened Cary Arts Center. Opening night is November 30th for the one-weekend run. Director and Cary Players founder Dan Marchenko says audiences will enjoy familiar scenes, including the family's temperamental exploding furnace, the frozen flagpole, and the famous high-heeled leg lamp. Be there, or you get the lamp. Students recently pitched in and ran in the memory of Eve Carson, the UNC Chapel Hill student body president who was murdered in March 2008, and raised more than $52,000 that will go toward endowing a scholarship in her name and to two education nonprofits, First Book and CEO for Teens. Speaking at the November 3rd event, reports the Daily Tar Heel were Chancellor Holden Thorpe, former Chancellor James Moser, student body president Will Lehmanstall, two Eve Carton scholarship recipients, and Eve's brother, Andrew Carson. The winner of the race, by the way, was Ryan Catt, who was a freshman at Carolina when Carson was murdered. It's a really good atmosphere, and it's definitely for a great cause, and it was perfect weather, said Catt. When you have two headquarters in two countries, you have to spread out your giving. GlaxoSmithKline is donating $330,000 for community relief in the United States following last month's historic Hurricane Sandy. The company is also contributing $80,000 through the British Red Cross for its relief efforts in the wider Caribbean and is matching dollar for dollar all employee contributions to the Red Cross and other relief organizations in the United States. GlaxoSmithKline is one of the Research Triangle Park's largest employers. We've run out of time for this week's edition of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program will be available online at triangleReadingService.org immediately after the broadcast. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.